An NBA team sale has been called off, spurring a dispute that could become a legal issue. Plus, the legend of Caitlin Clark grows even more. And later, we're speaking to the president of the Utah Jazz as that team is in season one of a unique broadcasting experiment. It's Friday, March 29th. I'm Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. Alex Rodriguez and Mark Lowry appear to not be taking control of the Minnesota Timberwolves and Lynx after all. Joining me now to discuss is Front Office Sports newsletter writer Eric Fisher. Welcome, Eric.
Hello.
So A-Rod and Lowry agreed to buy the Timberwolves and Lynx in 2021. They set up a structure in which they would buy them in 20% installments. They already own 40% of the teams. Then a funder, the Carlyle Group, backed out last week, but it looked like it was still fine because Dyal Capital Partners seemed to be filling that gap. Now they're not buying the rest of the teams. What's going on here?
Well, we've got a difference of opinion as to exactly what happened here. The story from Glenn Taylor, the current majority owner, is that Lowry and Rodriguez did not meet the deadline, that there was a Wednesday deadline to meet to get this last tranche of the equity and for them to become the equity owners. What Lowry and Rodriguez are saying is that process is happening with the NBA and they're ready to close. And they're accusing Taylor of having seller's remorse at this point and essentially reneging on the deal.
Yeah. And they use those exact words, seller's remorse. And it seems like, I mean, Taylor might just be trying to get a little more money for a property that has substantially increased in value since they initially made the deal.
Yeah, there's a real bargain at play here because the deal struck 3 years ago, as you correctly indicate, $1.5 billion. The Timberwolves themselves are conservatively estimated at 2.5 now and soon to grow more once the new NBA national TV deals to get done. And the WNBA, as we've discussed many times, they're a rocket ship. And we had a team last year valued for $151 million. And so there's a huge bargain that's happening in this deal, and that may be informing what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, seems like Taylor might just be, you know, using a clause in the contract essentially to either hold on to the teams or to get more money.
And the other half of this is that the Timberwolves are having their best season in 20 years since the height of the Kevin Garnett era. They're half a game out from the best record in the Western Conference. All of the core metrics, such as attendance and local TV ratings, are way up. These are good times for a franchise that's had a lot of tough ones. And I think that's also factoring into this. And Taylor's kind of alluded to this himself, that he's just having a lot of fun right now. And that may be informing what's being, again, accused of seller's remorse.
Do we have any sense of what's going to happen here going forward? Because A-Rod and Lowry own 40% of the Timberwolves and the Lynx. And yet they're at this impasse and probably not especially happy with the majority owner, but they were already, you know, pretty involved with the team and they're still the principal minority owners or the largest minority shareholders. What do you think happens from going forward?
Well, certainly, as you indicate correctly, the status quo is very awkward right now. So some things are going to need to happen here. The NBA has not said anything yet and whether and where that approval process actually stands, and if in fact Rodriguez and Lowry are correct that they're continuing to head down that track towards getting this last tranche approved. So that's the first immediate thing that we're waiting on. And then longer term, does this get to some sort of legal situation, whether an outright lawsuit or some type of mediation or arbitration? Because clearly we've still got this fundamental difference of opinion as to whether the original sale contract was adhered to or not. Taylor says it was not, that they did not meet the terms, and then ergo no deal. The other side obviously saying this thing is still happening. So that's got to have to be settled at some point. And again, we're waiting to see what that other shoe drop is going to be, whether it involves a courtroom or not.
Yeah, it feels like something legal is going to have to happen here, given that the dispute is about a contract and whether and which side is fulfilling it or not fulfilling it. Anything else that you're watching out for as this unfolds?
Yeah, again, the big thing is where the league is on this. there will probably be some sort of kind of perfunctory statement or something base factual there. But writ large, what does Adam Silver have to say about this? He'll have other points of public availability, media availability, and he's going to have to weigh in at some point on this as well. And so, again, that league piece is something that I'm really interested to see because they're the ones who have to sign off on this. They're the ones that originally blessed this whole three-part process. And so that's really the big thing, first and foremost, I'm looking out for.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Eric Fisher, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Quick reminder that throughout March Madness, we are giving out one Front Office Sports hat per day. All you have to do is rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, screenshot the review, and send it to me at owen@frontofficesports.com. Caitlin Clark is joining a club that includes Serena Williams, Tom Brady, Kobe Bryant, and John Madden. That would be people who are subjects of an ESPN The Magazine special edition. 96 pages of Caitlin Clark-focused content is hitting the newsstands today. Clark has become one of those stars that transcends her own league and becomes a cultural phenomenon, and through that, she is a symbol of the heights that women's basketball can reach. The special edition will arrive the day before Iowa's Sweet 16 game against Colorado, which could be her last as a college player. From there, she's the presumptive first pick in the WNBA draft on April 15th, just 8 days after the women's final. But Clark does have other offers on the table. Ice Cube has offered her $5 million to join his Big Three basketball league. "Why wouldn't we?" said Cube. Caitlin is a generational athlete who can achieve tremendous success in the Big Three. It's unclear if Clark would be able to play in the Big Three and the WNBA simultaneously. The guess here is no, but the offer itself, plus the special edition, are just two more indications of Clark's high-altitude status. Here's a riddle for you. Minor League Baseball has added an extra team, but no extra players. How is this possible, you ask? The answer is the Malmö Oat Milkers, who are both none of the teams and all of them. Make sense? No? Okay, I'll explain. Through a unique deal between Minor League Baseball and Oatly, the oat milk company based in Malmö, Sweden, each of the 120 minor league teams will spend one game this year in which they swap out their own identity for that of the Malmö Oat Milkers. I legitimately don't know if this is a dumb idea or a great one, but I do know that minor league baseball teams take themselves much less seriously than MLB, and this is the kind of thing that they can get away with that major league teams can't. Up next, the Utah Jazz have become cord cutters. They are pioneering a broadcasting model that I think has the chance to become how many teams operate, at least for an interim period, while we move towards some kind of post-cord cutting paradigm. I spoke with Utah Jazz president Jim Olson on how that's going and what they've learned, and that conversation is coming up next. Very excited to be joined now by Utah Jazz president Jim Olson. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you on. So the Jazz and the Suns are trying a new formula when it comes to broadcasting games. You have an over-the-air broadcaster in KJZZ, and you have your team-focused streaming service, Jazz Plus. What you don't have is a cable regional sports network. How's life in the post-cable world?
Yeah, no, life's been incredible. It's been, quite frankly, it's been better than we could have dreamt up. You know, we, as you mentioned, we broke the model, went away from the typical RSN relationship and went over the air free to the entire state of Utah. We went from, you know, reaching 39% of our marketplace through the RSN deal to now reaching 100% of the entire market free over the air. So we've been very pleased with the results.
Mm-hmm. And what's that meant for your viewership to have to be accessible to everyone in your area?
Yeah, I mean, I look at that two ways. First of all, you know, our viewership is up 53% over the previous year. Wow. So obviously more people are watching our games. You know, everybody knows there's the cord cutters, there's people that have never, you know, had subscription TV and you're just not able to reach those. And so, as mentioned, you know, we're up 53%. And then, but I think there's another story that's really important. And that's the story of, you know, just what it's meant to our fans that we would make a move like this to provide our games over the air, and just the narrative, the connection it's made with our fans and the community. It's been a great success.
Is there anything that you lost through cutting the cord with cable that you're trying to reincorporate into your current broadcasting system?
No, there's really not. We were really fortunate. We've always produced our own games. We never relied upon the RSN partner to produce our games. We produce our own games. We've always sold all of our own advertising, even previous, in our RSN deal. And so it just was not a challenging transition. I mean, there were some challenges technically, we'll say, but we produce our games. We sell the advertising for our games. We've always hired our own talent, the broadcasters, and really all it is sending the signal to a new over the air station. And, we had to come up with the new graphics package and, some other small details, but we didn't leave anything behind and we just picked up a lot. And, quite frankly, I've even learned, I will admit, I wasn't completely up to date on over the air broadcasting. The picture's even better, with over the air. So for those that pay very, very close attention to the quality of picture, we've got a clear picture. If you can imagine, I mean, the pictures are already very clear on new TVs and broadcast equipment, but by going over the air, it actually made it even clearer and, just another added benefit.
And have you found that your reach on the over the air part, I mean, anyone can access it, but because of the world we live in now, not everyone has a setup with an antenna. And the Suns even went as far as shipping out antennas to people who asked for them. Has that been a hurdle for you in terms of reaching folks?
No, not really. Two things on that. One is, when we first, once again, I was a little bit out of touch with what over the air meant. And when we first started having that conversation, I went back to my childhood of having big antennas up on top of your house. And I thought, are people really going to go, where can you even buy those antennas? And are people going to go buy them? And where do you buy them? And are they going to climb up on their roof and install it? Come to find out, you buy an antenna on Amazon or anywhere else and you connect it to the back of your TV and you have your antenna. And so it's really a simple process, but I think where we felt even more confident about, that question mark was rolling out our streaming platform and, rolling out Jazz Plus, where we get it. There's a whole generation that may not have TVs and watching on their iPads or phones or laptops, whatever it may be. And, that's why rolling out Jazz Plus was a real priority for us and not just those watching at home, but being able to watch on the go. You're sitting at your kid's soccer game or at work in the evenings, but your work, you can put your phone somewhere and have the game streaming. And so, having that streaming option was really important to us.
So your previous cable RSN deal reportedly earned the team $20 million annually. What's your projection for when you'll get back to that level of broadcast revenue?
Yeah, we're really focused on that. It's not going to be in year one or maybe not year two, but we're really confident and things are trending that in the next 3-4 years we're gonna be whole. And not only are we going to be whole, but with new content, with the increase, increasing the awareness of our streaming package and, some advertising revenue, so forth. We're very confident we'll end up surpassing where we were, and it financially will end up being another great part of the success story.
And is that growth you're anticipating? Is that more streaming subscribers primarily, or how important a piece is the over the air part of that?
Yeah, it's everything. That's the difference. With an RSN deal, they cut you a check and you turn over all your rights and it's pretty clean cut and you get paid one way. And what we're doing is finding every possible way that we can get paid. And subscriptions are very important. Advertising is very important. And then you break down the advertising into special content. How you're getting, sponsorship for special content and, other types of revenue streams that way. And so, instead of just, getting one paycheck, we've created, a handful of different revenue streams that we'll continue to tap into to get that revenue back.
Part of me thinks that the team-specific streaming service, you know, not just in basketball, in any sport, is a sort of an intermediary step. It won't last forever because, in your case, you've got NBA League Pass that allows anyone outside of the Utah area to watch Jazz games. You know, obviously, same with the Suns and PHX Live. I'm wondering if at some point you see a world where we don't have these regional blackouts and, you know, something like Jazz Plus would be a hard sell to someone who can just get the entire NBA from one streaming service. Would you agree with that? Or do you think, you know, we're going to be seeing these streaming services maybe propagate and they'll be around, you know, decades to come?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. We ask ourselves that a lot. I think our goal is that we're going to continue to put out the best streaming product possible that people would rather come to us and, you know, inside content, behind the scenes and, you know, in game, even, you know, technology is going to change with, you know, altcasts and things you can do with altcasts. And I just think it's hard to say. I don't know. I think you bring up a really good point that it is going to change. I don't think it's going to be exactly what it is today, but I do think that I think there's a long runway for what we're doing, and teams are going to be very successful in this.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so right now it's you guys and the Suns. Do you see other teams following this model? Like are cable RSNs, you know, going to be a thing of the past in, you know, let's say 5-10 years?
Yeah, that's another tough question too. I will tell you, we get calls from teams all the time. How are you doing it? How'd you do this? How did this work out? There's some challenges for other teams. And for us, you know, I think the reason why we were able to do it and why it's been so successful is we didn't approach this just from a financial standpoint. If you're just looking at the dollars, it's a tougher conversation. If you are looking at your fan experience, your connection with your fan base, your growing your fan base, giving your fans really what they want and what they expect, like it becomes an easier decision. So I think as other teams look at it, you know, the dollars come into play, but it's where you prioritize those dollars versus your fans, the experience and, you know, building that fan base, building your brand, and, you know, just making it something great that it's become.
Yeah, and it's occurring to me now, both the Jazz and the Suns have relatively new ownership groups. You know, Ryan Smith bought the Jazz in 2020. The Suns were bought, was it last year? Anyway, it's I'm wondering if there's something to that where, you know, new owner, new-ish owner, willing to try new things, maybe not as tied to previous relationships. Is that something that you think is a factor here?
Yeah, I really do. I remember very early on, you know, Ryan Smith asking me, is it true that we only reach 39% of the marketplace through our TV deal? And I answered, yeah, that's accurate. And he said, well, that's got to change. And, you know, we still had a little bit of time left on our existing deal, our RSN deal. So it gave us time to brainstorm and think about what our priorities were going to be. And Ryan played a very large role in moving this forward. And, you know, his commitment that it was more about than just the money, you know, made our jobs a lot easier.
And zooming out a little bit, you worked for a long time under the Miller family who sold the team to Ryan Smith. How would you compare the two ownership groups?
Yeah, I mean, they're both, you know, great families, both very dedicated to Utah. You know, I worked for the Millers for about 26 years and they built the Jazz. Larry and Gail Miller actually were the ones that stepped up back in the 80s to buy the team to keep it from moving from Utah because they're so dedicated to Utah. And when it came time for them to sell, they weren't going to just sell to anybody. They were only going to sell to someone who was just as committed to keep the team in Utah. And so what's been great is through, you know, my whole 30 years, I've been able to be a part of, you know, ownership groups that care about Utah and are focused on Utah and, you know, want to build, you know, the Jazz and other business entities to, you know, to build up Utah. And so a lot of similarities. I mean, you know, Ryan comes in with a young tech background, you know, built his career in tech and has a lot of great ideas and different ways of looking at things. And a lot of them have been working. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And on that commitment to Utah, I mean, it's a mid-sized market, right? Isn't it? It's not New York, it's not LA, but it's, you know, not a small town either. You know, Salt Lake City isn't. I'm wondering how much was that a conversation around the sale of, you know, if we sell this to some people, are they gonna, you know, try to find a new market? Was that a real present, tangible thing at that around that time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what was really interesting is, you know, and according to the Millers, and they spoke to us about it, you know, they really didn't intend on selling. They hadn't, it wasn't a long process where they'd been thinking about selling. It really happened really quick where Gail Miller decided the time was right, you know, to sell the team. And I think Ryan was the only one she would have sold it to, because there are markets that want NBA teams. There's markets that are bigger than Utah, or equivalent even, and, you know, probably could be successful, but it was just never going to be an option to sell to anybody that where there'd be a risk of it ever leaving Utah.
Jim Olson, appreciate the time. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
That's it for today. Rate and review us on Apple. Send me a screenshot at owen@frontofficesports.com for a chance to get a free hat. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you on Monday.